You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, but not sunny Davis day. And, you know, it's sort of a cloudy, but bright. It's
partly kind of weird. Partly cloudy is the term that the Weather Service likes to use for this, not to be confused with partly sunny. Lois and I
have never figured out the difference between those two.
More clouds means partly cloudy. Less clouds means partly sunny. That's my best guess. I have no idea what percentage they use. We're recording this show on November 12th for broadcast November 13, 2025. And according to the National Weather Service, right now in Davis, it's overcast. Sitting here in Dixon looking out the window, I do see sunshine. It's quite lovely, but there are clouds moving in, and there definitely is a change in the weather that will have occurred by the time this airs. So there's a chance of showers today, Wednesday, and then pretty good strong chance. All the models have converged on this with new precipitation amounts tonight, Wednesday night before the show, quarter to half an inch possible. Thursday we'll have showers, new precipitation amounts Thursday. They pushed it back a little bit from when I looked at this yesterday, between 1 to 2 inches possible. Ooh. That's the Davis forecast.
Wow.
Previously, they'd only been saying about 3/4 of an inch to 1 inch. This is a pretty sizable storm system that will be pulling through here as you're listening to the show tomorrow. And Thursday night, new precipitation about 1/10 to 1/4 of an inch. Friday, a chance of showers. Friday night clearing, well, partly cloudy. Saturday, mostly sunny. And the temperature range over the next week. Today is 69. Day of the broadcast, 63 degrees. Night temperature, it's only going to be 59 Wednesday night. Thursday night, 49. And we're going to start dropping into the 40s at night pretty consistently now. Saturday, mostly sunny with a high near 67. Saturday night, mostly cloudy, 49. Sunday, slight chance of showers, mostly cloudy, high near 60. The high on Sunday is only going to be 60 degrees. Sunday night, chance of showers, mostly cloudy, low around 49. None of those are likely to give us significant rainfall, but there's going to be pretty good amounts of rain and snow all around us. And they're getting, you know, snow up in the mountains and so forth. So this is good water-wise for the state of California. Just once again, third storm series in a row, primarily going above, over, or around us. Not getting that much here. Sunday night, chance of showers, 49 degrees. Monday, chance of showers, 59 degrees. Monday night, this is the important part, 44 degrees. Okay, dropping down below 45. Tuesday, sunny with a high near 61. So we are getting some colder night temperatures. And I went back and just looked over the last, 5 years, what has been our earliest date of frost. Date of first frost in the last 5 years. Yes, we do get frost here. So last year, our first frost was on November 17th, 2023. Our first frost was on November 9th. We also had frost on the 11th and the 27th in November of 2023. 2022, first frost was on November 14th, and we had 4 visible, measurable frosts in November that year. 2021, first frost was on November 22nd, and again on November 25th. And in 2020, our first frost was November 9th, again on the 10th, and again on the 12th. This is notable. In 2020, on the 10th, Davis low temperature was 28.9 degrees. Ooh. And on the 12th, 2 days later, it was 28.8 degrees. So in the last 5 years, our first date of frost has ranged between the 9th and the 17th, 22nd, I should say. Sometime mid-November is more typical. 1 to 2 frosts in November are pretty common. They usually occur, and the reason I mention this now, right after a storm When we then get a high pressure ridge building, sometimes accompanied by a north wind, I would say the likeliest is looking at Monday night because they're talking about 44 degrees and partly cloudy. If those clouds clear out, it's open to the sky as we go into the evening, there's a possibility that we'd have a frost of that kind, those kind of weather conditions. It doesn't look like it because that's still part of a series of small storms coming through. We generally don't have frost here when we have clouds and rain. Usually it's right after them when it clears out and a high pressure ridge builds up. But we're getting close to the time of year with the first frost. Now, the measured temperature on those dates of visible frost was often 33 or 34 degrees. It doesn't have to be 32 degrees, the freezing point of water, for us to see frost on surfaces. But we did get below 32 degrees on some of those occasions. And the reason I mention this is twofold. One, as we talked about in previous shows, it's time for you to bring any tropical plants indoors and any subtropical plants closer to the house if you're concerned about frost injury on them. The other is I keep getting people thinking we don't get frost here. And our first frost typically is sometime in the middle of November. Our last frost of consequence is usually mid to late February, but we do get light frost in early March. And I even have pictures of frost occurring as late as late March or early April. Those are anomalous, those late kind of frost. Typically, our period here, when you can have frost on surfaces and injury to truly tropical plants and some injury to subtropical plants, is mid-November to mid to late February. That's our climate. And I do want people to understand we still do get cold enough to do injury. Remember that the USDA zones are based on 5-degree increments. And if I'm telling you that in the last 5 years, we've been below 30 degrees at least once every one of those years, we're zone 9B, not 10. We're USDA zone 9B in Davis. Those of us out in the country, that's 25 degrees. We get below 25 degrees every couple of years, and it can do a significant amount of injury to some of those plants you guys in town do better with. And that puts us in zone 9A. So that's where we are in Davis, Woodland. You're in zone 9B. Out in the country, you're in zone 9A. That's important to know because there's a lot of plants sold in larger chain stores that are really only hardy to USDA zone 10. And so I want you to understand when you buy those are plants that need to come close to the house or even indoors, depending on what they are. We go over that. And if you've got questions, wherever you are about the hardiness of particular groups of plants, the ones we usually talk about, citrus, hibiscus, things like that. But there's others that you may be concerned about, Brugmansias, Mandevillas, Diplodenias, plants that you've purchased and really want to know whether you're going to get it through the winter. That's where we are in this part of California. USDA zone 9B for most of you, 9A for those of us who are on rural properties. Let's see. The Arboretum has some upcoming events. In particular, the last plant sale, public clearance plant sale, is this Saturday, November 15th. Open to everyone, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Arboretum Teaching Nursery. Still looks like a good updated inventory is it's present. Okay, it's already present. Excel spreadsheet or Adobe Acrobat, as you prefer. Lots of plants still there. Saturday, November 15th, public clearance and plant sale. Also, on their event page, get ready to immerse yourself in the vivid beauty of the UC Davis Arboretum by embarking on a midday adventure through gardens and collections with your guide, Warren Roberts, Superintendent Emeritus on the Walk with Warren. Next upcoming Walk with Warren is November 19th at noon. And you need to get directions. It's at the Shields Gazebo. Go to arboretum.ucdavis.edu. Stroll around with Warren Roberts. Immerse yourself not just in the vivid beauty, but the puns and the stories and the entertainment is above par. That's not what I wanted to say.
It's excellent. It's just
Excellent.
excellent
Excellent.
done.
Yes. Thank you very much. And the Weed Out Stress event.
Oh,
Your
yeah.
experience, no problem. All community members are invited to join Arboretum folks for a Weed Out Stress volunteer gardening session. Yep, it's been raining. Weeds have been coming up. Time to pull them out or hoe them off. Spend time outside among plants and good company. We're lending a helping hand, and the next event is November 21. For information, just go to the events page at arboretum.ucdavis.edu. KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And we've got questions and topics and comments. Where do we begin, Lois?
Well, first, I want to get some more coming in. So, listeners, if you have something to tell us about, what do they write, Don?
DavisGardenShow@gmail.com, and they can send pictures. They can send a video. We got a video this week. That's really cool. We'll get to that in a moment.
We'll get to that. Okay. So for right now, I want to start with Tara, or Tara. I'm not sure how you pronounce your
I would say
name.
Tara, personally, but
So Oakland is where Tara lives.
yeah.
And she writes, "Good morning. I'm hoping you can help me with two citrus questions. My beer's Persian lime, which you helped me ID last year, has some upper branches that have possible pest damage that I don't recognize. The leaves are distorted, discolored, and have squiggly trails in them. I also noticed some black on a few leaves, but I haven't seen ants. I definitely have slugs on the lower 8 inches of the tree, but this doesn't look like they're damaged. Do you know what it is, and is there anything I should do?"
Okay, that is citrus leaf miner. Citrus leaf miner showed up in California. I think it was about 15 years ago. I'd have to go back and find when I first wrote an article about this. Came in from the south in this particular case, and it yeah, there's little train tracks, little tunnels or mines in the leaves of the young of citrus trees. The young leaves only, they can only oviposit in tender leaves, and they do have a high-ish temperature requirement, so they don't show up super early in the season. Now, coastal growers will have different experience somewhat than those of us here in the interior. We first saw this problem, as I say, 10 or 15 years ago. Within a year or two of it arriving in the valley, pretty much every citrus tree I looked at, the new growth in mid to late summer, had these little train track things in the leaves. They're actually kind of cool and interesting. It is a larva of a rather boring moth. And if it were, something like a monarch butterfly, we'd be happy about this, but no. And it just makes a trail, and above the trail is a glossy sheen to the leaf, and it also can heavily distort the leaves of the citrus if it hits them at this particular stage of expansion. One problem we have in the valley is that also happens to be about the time thrips are usually attacking the tender growth of citrus, so they cause buckling and distortion of the leaves as well. Here's the thing. It's in the leaf, not on the leaf. So to kill it, you'd need to apply something that would go into the leaf to kill it. That would be a systemic. Systemic on a plant that has food isn't something most home gardeners want to do. And honestly, those systemics aren't, frankly, all that effective on leaf miners anyway. Here's the key bottom line. It doesn't really hurt the plant that much. It doesn't prevent photosynthesis, except where it really damages the leaf. No pesticide really works on it that readily, and it doesn't affect the fruit. It doesn't affect the yield, doesn't affect the quality, doesn't even affect the appearance of the fruit. I will mention, as it came north, a peel miner also showed up, but I've seen the peel miner maybe three times total since these showed up 10, 15 years ago. I've seen leaf miner on just about every citrus tree that I look at. So there's a huge difference between how these two pests have arrived and the damage that they've done. In coastal areas where people grow limes and lemons, and they tend to flush their growth early and they tend to have a lot of flushes of new growth, you can get a surprising amount of this leaf miner on a young tree, and it seems like it may be stunting the tree. So people want to spray for it. All right, if you want to do that, you can buy at your local garden center in the Bay Area, you can probably find pheromone traps, which you can hang in the tree and monitor them, learn what the adult looks like. When they show up, you can spray to kill the adult. And there's a variety of sprays, including some that are very low impact, spinosad being a good example, that'll kill the adult if you happen to time it right. So it shows up in the trap, you spray with that. And people who are doing this every 2 to 3 weeks from late spring through the summer and into the fall, they end up spraying in order to try and prevent the leaf miner. It will outgrow it. It's not hurting the young tree that much. It definitely doesn't seem to hurt older trees all that much. And so I don't think it's necessary to spray, but I do understand that this disfigures the foliage and it really bothers people. So the next question we always get is, should I prune it out? Well, you're removing leaves that are photosynthesizing when you do that. So you're doing more harm than the leaf miner, at least in theory. I don't think pruning it out is necessary except for cosmetic reasons. Moreover, it can only oviposit on tender new growth. What happens when you prune a tree? You get tender new growth. So pruning the tree to remove the leaf miner stimulates new growth that'll then become infested with leaf miner. I don't think in the long run that does all that much either. You can, this is fun, follow the little train track in the leaf right to the end where it is. If it hasn't gotten to the edge of the leaf yet, take your thumb and forefinger and squish it. You've killed that larva and you'll feel better. You've probably done nothing to the population, but at least you've killed that one. Because when it gets all the way to the end, it comes back out, drops down to the ground, pupates, flies back up, and reinfests. We typically get, I think, three or four infestation cycles here in the valley, but in coastal areas, they do get more than that. So I don't think any control is necessary for this. Now that we've had it long enough, to see what the pattern is. As trees grow and get more established, the problem diminishes, not just as a percentage of leaves that are affected, but overall. I mean, when my mandarins first got this, the bigger old established trees on the property, all the new growth was affected. Now less and less of it is every year. We know that there are beneficial insects that do control this pest to some degree. They either have to attack the adult as it's ovipositing, or in case of a couple of them, they oviposit right through the leaf into the larva and they manage to kill it that way. So we do know that over time, beneficial insects will give a good level of control. As the tree gets more mature, you'll have less of a problem. As long as you can put up with the damage on young plants, remove the worst leaves if they bother you, squish the larva now and then, probably you don't need to do anything more than that. But be aware that if you're feeding your tree heavily and getting lots of vigorous growth, or pruning it hard and stimulating lots of growth, you're increasing the leaf miter. So feed appropriately, not heavily, and probably just put up with it would be my suggestion for citrus leaf miter.
So you're talking about the leaf that has the little tunneling through
it. Yeah, really obvious.
Leaf miter. But there were a lot of leaves up there that were cupped and curled and distorted and bloated. Is that also the leaf miter?
Probably. I mentioned the problem we have here is that at the same time leaf miter is hitting, we tend to get thrips on our citrus as well, and they cause distortion. But if the leaf miter attacks the leaf in the expansion phase, it can buckle and cup very dramatically and look really awful. And if they complete, you know, they go squiggling down the leaf, it looks like, you know, the kind of... can't remember the term we use, a switchback.
Slalom.
Looks like a switchback trail. And if they complete a loop, the area in between can die. You know, that part of the leaf may die, and you might even get a little bacterial infection there, causing that leaf to look really rough. Sure, pick that off. That's absolutely fine. If you pick it off, I just put it in a bag and get rid of it. If it's a small enough tree, that may be one way to manage it. In the long run, this is not particularly harmful. And the emphasis, once I say this part, most people go, oh, fine. Doesn't affect the fruit. Okay, which is what you're growing the tree for. Now, I did have a couple that was buying, I think they were kumquats, which don't get it real badly, but they're buying them as ornamentals to put in big urns on their driveway as a sort of a focal formal thing. And they had some little leaf miter on the young plants they were about to buy. And the wife said, do they get this every year? I said, yeah, they absolutely do. If this really bothers you, I wouldn't use this plant because you're just not going to be happy. It's going to happen every year.
Okay, so if I just... So the leaf miner leaf, the one with the slalom tracks, is still photosynthesizing.
Yeah.
But those cupped and curled and distorted ones, they're not doing very much because there's not much green on them.
Right.
If I just cut off those leaves, I wouldn't be stimulating new growth because I'm not cutting the whole top of the tree, right?
To a degree. Yeah. I mean, the less you prune, the better in terms of stimulating new growth, but it's okay to remove the stuff that's infested if it bothers you. Yeah.
Okay.
Any green leaf is photosynthesizing, so that's something to keep in mind. But yeah, remove the ugly parts if they particularly bother you. There was another part to the question, though.
Well, no, but this tree, before we leave, this tree had lots of leaves. It was really looking really healthy, except for this one problem.
Yeah.
Okay. So Tara also writes, the last photo is of our tangerine tree. Our first year here, it had a fantastic crop. This second year, nothing and hardly any blooms. Are they biennial blooming? Admittedly, I don't know how many irrigation emitters go to this tree, but I did make an effort to drip a hose on it about every 3 weeks for an hour through most of the summer. And then she shows a picture of... Can you describe this, Don?
It's a nice, healthy tree. I do see another tree crowding it a bit, but I will say, to answer your question, the term you're looking for is alternate bearing, and mandarins in particular, but are known to be alternate bearing. In fact, commercial growers who do Satsuma mandarins know they're going to have heavy years and light years, and that's just the way it goes. There's nothing to be done about it once they settle into that pattern particularly. So it is not a concern to me. The plant basically looks healthy. I do see another tree pretty close. It's, you know, I've got a branch going over it. So I would remove that branch or remove that tree because citrus need full sun. And remember, this is in the coast. So you really need as much sun as you can get there to get good yield and also good flavor. You want full sun for your mandarins, and you want them to get as much chilling in the winter to get that nice balance of sweet and tart that we like in mandarins. So you want to get that other tree away from there. But otherwise, it looks good. If your tree has grown 1 to 2 feet each year, good general rule, folks, if your citrus are growing 1 to 2 feet each year at least, sometimes more. Then they're putting on enough new growth to get fruit down the road when that wood finally comes into production. If they're not growing at all, then they will go into a very light production mode. But what you're seeing is probably just plain alternate bearing. The other plants that are known for alternate bearing are persimmons. And I've had several people comment that they have hardly any fruit on their persimmon trees this year, myself included. I did verify that that wasn't simply because of tree squirrels, which can be another factor, but persimmons are known for alternate bearing. Apricots are known for alternate bearing. And that was a discovery that enriched some farmers nearly a century ago here in the Sacramento Valley. They found that not only could they get them to market early, because the apricots would ripen early here, but if they could get their trees off of the alternate cycle that all their neighbors' trees were on, they could make a lot more money. In the year that they had a heavy crop, everyone else would have a light crop. So a lot of research and pruning techniques were adopted to try and reduce the alternate bearing of apricots, and some farmers became quite wealthy by doing so. So that's another one. And pecans are notable for being strongly alternate bearing. And the old pecan tree on my property goes back and forth to the point of almost no pecans some years, followed by heavy crops alternate years. So those are the four in particular: mandarins, apricots, pecans are well known for it, and persimmons, it does happen as well.
Okay. All right. Well, that brings me to a message from Henry in Michigan. And as you may recall, we talked about his having a cold area in the winter. Now, Michigan, we're talking, when we're talking cold, we're talking minus zero Fahrenheit.
Well, not in his
No, but I mean the outside air.
sunroom,
When we're in California and we say, oh, it's going to get down below 40. Well, come on, man.
Well,
We're
what he
talking
said,
about
actually, specifically what
20
he said,
degrees.
he was going to make sure that it didn't get below 50. And our comment, just a quick recap, was talking about ferns, for example, things like that. Or there are some orchids that we discussed, and there are certain other houseplants that are subtropical, not tropical, like the ficus, or subtropical, not tropical in most cases. So they would probably be okay as long as it doesn't get much below 50 degrees. Actually, after the conversation, I was looking through some of my pictures, and I found a maidenhair fern, which I had grown as a house plant for 3 years. We used them as table displays when my kid got married, and I brought them home, and by the way, they were in bowls that didn't drain. So this was one of those things that I was doing that I don't recommend. They're just for the table decorations. So we just put maidenhair ferns from 4-inch or quart pots into lovely ceramic bowls that did not have drain holes, watered very carefully to settle them. They looked very pretty in the center of each table. And then I took them home, and they lasted for a very good long time. Maidenhair ferns, many of them can go down well below freezing, although they may be deciduous in that situation. 50 degrees, 45 degrees into the 30s is absolutely fine with them. So you might consider some of those. I hadn't thought about them last time. But now Henry sent us a picture of his
Well,
current purchases.
let me read his comment. Thank you for reading my email on your show. I thought that I'd share with you some of my plants that I bought this summer. They are all calatheas or calatheas. How do you pronounce that?
I first learned it as Calathea, and then I heard everybody saying Calathea. Take your pick.
Okay,
See?
C-A-L-A-T-H-E-A-S. I do have them in my sunroom. I do keep them grouped together for their humidity needs.
Yep.
Look at my video. Oh, he sent a video.
Yeah, I opened it. This
And
is
if you can
great.
give me any suggestions on the care of these, as well as should I bring them into the house and use grow lights over the winter, seeing that it does get a little cold in my sunroom. Love your show from Henry in cold and cloudy Michigan.
Yes, indeed. Well, it's a big group. They're generally described as tropical, although some of them go into subtropical areas. And that, when you go on to Wikipedia as an example, they'll say they prefer temperatures 60 degrees and above. They can go down to 50. I'm not concerned about them going down to 50 degrees. If they go below that, I would be. These are not plants that typically would be exposed to temperatures in the 30s, and that would definitely be harmful. I've done very well in general with Calatheas or Calatheas, the related Tenanthes. This is one of my favorites because it's Cten Anthe. Tenanthe, the C is silent, closely related. And the Marantas, which are the prayer plants that we all grew 50 years ago. Prayer plants were probably the best known of the group. If any of these get too dry, the leaves will burn really badly. If the humidity is low, they may burn on the tips, although I think that's an overstated concern. They're always described as needing high humidity, but I haven't particularly had that experience. What they really do need is good drainage. They need soil that has got lots of stuff added to it for drainage. So they rot really easily, and when they rot, they just go like overnight. I've done very well with a Calathea or Calathea, and it'll go on for months and months, and then all of a sudden I'll water it once too frequently in the summer, rare problem in my case, and it will suddenly just literally completely collapse. There's no saving it once that happens. So be aware that root rot is probably the most common problem on them. Temperatures below 50 would concern me, but I think you're probably okay out there, as long as you make sure it doesn't get below. If you have trouble maintaining that temperature during, extreme cold event, sure, they could come into the house during that time period. And my experience is they like at least medium to bright light. That seems to be the most important. They haven't done well for me in low light parts of my house. But as someone who's really not good at house plants, I've found them very satisfactory. Okay.
So I looked at the video. Oh, it's a gorgeous set
They're
of
great.
plants you got there, Henry. I love it. I hope they make it. But some of them look like prayer plants. Are these prayer plants?
The ones he has look like they're all Calatheas or Calatheas. I don't think he has any Marantas in there, but it's all the same family. So prayer
Okay.
plant, Calathea, Tenanthe are all closely related. I've done very well with them in general. I think they're one of the groups of the fairly new group of houseplants. Over the last 5 to 10 years, when houseplants have gone through another big cycle of popularity, particularly around COVID and the year or two thereafter, these came onto the market in a big way. And where there used to just be a couple of varieties, now there are a bunch of them. I've done very well with them, except for the root rot or crown rot issue, where they can just suddenly succumb to. Well, they're water molds, but it's because of excess moisture around the crown.
And do you carry these at your
Oh,
store? I
yes,
mean, is that where I would go to find
I
these?
stock these all the time. Any good houseplant store, our store, the houseplant store downtown, we're always going to have lots of these because they're easy for us to grow, easy for us to sell, and they make a nice combination with other things. If you're buying like a flowering plant for the holiday and you want to make a little grouping, these make a nice foliage to go with that beautiful amaryllis bulb you just potted up, or the poinsettia that you decided to buy this year.
Okay, next. Oh my goodness. Annie, hi, Don and Lois. Thank you both for being superlative gardening gurus. Your show is only second to my small grandchildren as the delight of my week.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah. Our yard in San Rafael, and that's in the Bay Area, Sunset Zone 16. 16? Oh, okay. Seems to be infested with gophers.
16 is up. If you go to the Bay Area and you're in Berkeley and you're standing by the beach, you're in zone 17. If you go uphill, you're in zone 16.
Oh,
The way it was
okay.
described to me years ago, and maybe Annie can attest to this, in zone 17, your bougainvillea would grow but not bloom. In zone 16, it would grow and bloom because you get more heat because
Cool.
you're above the fog a little
Cool,
bit.
because it's a sunset zone, not
Yeah. Oh, yes. USDA zone 16 would be very tropical.
yeah.
Totally different numbering system. Yes. Good
All
point.
right. All
Okay.
right. Our traps occasionally work, but not often enough.
Yeah.
My veggies do okay because they're planted in raised beds, which are protected from the soil below by hardware cloth.
Yeah,
And for those of you who don't remember, hardware cloth is a metal mesh kind of thing. And all other plants are planted inside gopher baskets because if they aren't, they're immediately uprooted by these darn gophers. I am starting to plant bulbs. My understanding is that gophers don't like daffodils. Although it seems like some that I have planted in years past have disappeared. What other bulbs and plants are distasteful to gophers? Thank you ever so much for all of your wonderful and entertaining gardening knowledge and insights. And thank you, Annie, for sending us such, oh, lovely messages. So, Don, gophers.
Don't plant tulips or lilies. I can tell you that because gophers absolutely love both of those. Gopher is a native animal here in California, and we came and we started planting things, and they thought that was just paradise. They loved all the stuff we were putting in for them. They are my number one problem on my farm. They are a big problem in agriculture, and gardeners in the area battle them. I have seen lists of plants that they don't feed on, and they appear to be entirely anecdotal. But in the case of bulbs, we do know it is a fact that nothing eats narcissus or daffodil bulbs because they're apparently poisonous and unpalatable. And if you didn't, if one didn't come back, I doubt it was a gopher. It probably just rotted. That also happens occasionally. And I do see that Sloat Gardens, which is a garden center in the San Francisco Bay Area, does have a list of gopher-resistant plants. And I concur with the following bulbs that they have mentioned on their list: Scylla, Scilla, which includes wood hyacinths. And let's see, there's a couple of Scylla peruviana, which is a bulb that has really pretty flowers. So Scyllas are a possibility. Narcissus and daffodils. Amaryllis belladonna, the naked lady bulb, as we call it, the Amaryllis belladonna. That's correct. They've never eaten mine, and mine are in an area where gophers are very active. The Allium group, which includes onions and garlic. Now, saying that, have any of you out there had a problem with gophers feeding on your onions? Because I don't know for sure whether they eat onions or garlic or not. But the whole group then doesn't just include the vegetables, the onion and garlic in that genus. There's lots of ornamental alliums that are really striking, showy flowers, and can do quite well here in California. They're mostly from Mediterranean regions. They will generally multiply quite readily here. And they also mention muscari, which is the grape hyacinth. I haven't had experience with it one way or another. So those are bulbs that Sloat Garden Center, Bay Area nursery chain, has mentioned. So that's Scylla, Narcissus, Amaryllis belladonna, the Alliums, muscari, which is the grape hyacinth. And they also mention onion and garlic as being resistant, I guess, to gophers, whether or not they feed on them a little bit and don't like them or don't feed on them at all. My own experience has been, I've mentioned before, and this is just anecdotal, and I'm not making any promises by any stretch. I did read years ago when I had a huge problem with gophers in one area, which was in vegetables, when they took out 30 pepper plants in 30 days, and I just gave up on vegetables in that area. I read Rodale Institute, Publishers of Organic Gardening magazine, that they didn't like members of the mint family. Okay, what do I have to lose? So I stuck in a lavender plant everywhere they'd eaten a pepper. Those lavender plants are still there 20 years later. They did not eat, either they didn't eat the roots or they can sustain root injury. I don't know which. But when I realized they were not, and they were very active in that area, they were feeding on other things and tunneling and making their mounds and so on. It wasn't like they'd gone away. They were not attacking the lavender. So I stuck in salvias. They left them alone. I stuck in nepetas. They left them alone. These are all in the mint family. And I'm trying to remember what else went. Oh, oregano. Marjoram. So other kitchen herbs went in that area and they've never harmed them. And they still go through that area quite regularly. So anecdotally, I can tell you my experience has been that they don't seem to harm members of the mint family. Obviously, making no promises that this works everywhere, but that's been my observation. By comparison, if I stick a rose bush in the ground where gophers are active, they'll kill it immediately. There are some woody plants that seem to be able to get past the initial injury and establish, but roses in particular, anyone who's grown roses and dealt with gophers knows that they're just going to keep coming back and feeding on the roots over and over again. A big established rose bush on its own roots doesn't seem to have a problem. When you first plant it for the first couple of years, it's very, very vulnerable. So that's why the gopher cages are usually used in that situation.
Gophers are not big critters.
Nope.
They're fairly
They're the
small.
size of a tree
And
rat, basically.
how deep do they go to eat? What I'm thinking is, if the roots were down, once the roots got down far enough, wouldn't they be beyond the level of gopher
Seems
activity?
to be. It would be really nice if we had X-ray machines that could show us exactly what's going on down there. But I have observed years ago that most of their activity is in the top foot of soil. Because I had one area where I planted tomatoes several years back, and I put in, let's see, I put in 17 plants, I think it was, and they immediately took out several of them. And I thought, well, that's frustrating. These are little 4-inch or quart pot sized plants. So I wasn't going to give up. So I had some that I've shifted into 1 gallon cans, as I more typically do now for this reason. I let those plants get about 3 feet tall in the gallon containers. My kid had given me a soil auger that allowed me to drill down 2 feet
That's like a
deep.
post hole digger,
Yeah,
right?
except it's a power thing that you can put it on your drill,
Oh.
and you can drill a hole if your soil is reasonably workable, as mine is. And I could drill down 2 feet and pull that soil out and drop the 1 gallon tomato down to the bottom of a 18 to 24 inch hole and backfill. Now remember, this is a 3 foot tall plant, so there's a foot plus sticking out of the ground. And I would even have gophers surface around those plants like 3, 4 times, but not injure them because the roots were deeper than where they feed. So it did work, usually, in that instance, to plant the plant deeper. Now, I don't know how you do that with a bulb. I think if you put it down that deep, you would never see it again. But it does work. And this is the other thing. Yes, like a rose bush, once established. I have plenty of roses. I'm looking out at them right now that are great big plants that are fully established. They've been in the ground for 7 or 8 years. If they're feeding on the roots, it's not hurting them. They're probably not even feeding on most of those roots anymore. There are many that have gone deeper or gone further out, and they seem to be leaving them alone. But if I put a new one in, I know that that young plant will be vulnerable. I will tell you one thing I do when, because this is my major pest. When I put in like a couple of young citrus, I did on one side of the property. Gophers had not been active there for a few years. So I thought, okay, we're fine now. We can plant these trees here. Well, I was wrong. I put them in. I put a drip line to them, and the dripper is giving them water, and the gopher just followed right along the drip line and clearly did some injury to the young tree. I stopped using the drip system immediately and set sprinklers there instead. And what that does, I've observed this, that it will minimize the damage if you can catch it in time. Because now it's not just a nice line of loose soil for them to follow your drip tube. The whole area is loose soil. So they begin to become more random again. They'll go away from that tree and eat the weeds that are over there or eat whatever else. Whereas on my property, when I have a drip line with emitters and that's just watering the zone where the plants are, I might as well be putting mileage signs up, highway signs up for the gopher saying, new plants over here, come on over. So I put in two citrus in one area last summer, and the gophers immediately came in and damaged both of them. So I immediately stopped using drip and set sprinklers in there for the rest of the summer. The damage stopped. Okay. So they've injured those, but they've started to grow and they're still in the area, but they're over here and then they're over there and then they're over there. They're not carefully concentrating their injury where I had been irrigating. So if that's a useful bit of information for you, I hope it helps. These are all anecdotal observations. Traps work. You kill one, but they're territorial, so another one is just likely to move right back in. Flooding them out does not work. It's kind of fun to do, but it does not work. The gopher gasser things, which look like road flares, those don't work. None of those things work. And I don't want anybody using poisons for gophers because of the risk of secondary kill to raptors and pets. So we just don't want to do that.
Okay, if I took the bulb and I took a little bit of that hard earth cloth and I made a tube so that I'm putting the tube in, it's open at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
It
You're going to plant each bulb in each plant's going to have its own barrier? Well, that hypothetically would work. Yeah.
That should work, shouldn't it?
This would be rather tedious.
I mean, they aren't going to come to the bottom and come up.
What I would do in that situation is I would just dig a hole, pretend you're planting a rose bush, use that kind of a gopher cage, set your bulbs in the gopher in the cage and fill it with the soil, and then they would get past the damage.
That way you can do multiple bulbs with one cage.
Yeah, but it's a barrier.
That would be easier.
Yeah, barriers are with almost any vertebrate pest. Barriers are our first line of defense, whether they're under the plant, around the plant, in the bottom of the box, whatever. Whether, you know, if it's a bird, then the barrier has to be above. If it's a gopher, the barrier has to be below.
So, Annie, I hope this helped, and I hope you let us know how things go and how your bulbs grow next spring. So, Don, you got a note about grass seed. The question is, what brand is the blend that you're recommending? And this person says, on a website, it says mixture components are subject to change without notice.
Yes.
Subject to availability. The function and intention of the mix will remain unchanged. But that's not very satisfactory grass.
That reflects the turbulence of the grass seed industry, which is considerable. I was a listener who was interested in finding some of the grass seeds that I mentioned as a turf grass blend that I recommend in our area, grass seed combination mentioned on the show, and we also sell at our nursery. We sell the individual varieties. But if you're out of the area and you're looking for these specific varieties, this can become a little challenging. So I'll tell you where I get these. Our preferred mix in our area, the Central Valley of California, that I'm recommending for people who want a fairly typical fine-bladed grass lawn in their back or front, is roughly equal parts of a hard fescue and perennial ryegrass. Perennial ryegrass, we've talked about many times on the show because turf managers love it. It comes up quickly, fills in rapidly. So it's one of the things they use in commercial turf to just fill in areas that have been damaged by sporting events or whatever. Mostly old-fashioned perennial ryegrass was shiny green, looked a little different than the other grasses. Newer dark green, slower growing perennial ryegrass varieties have come on the market. The variety I started with and I highly recommend is one called Hat Trick, like a hat trick, hat trick. There's a newer one called Fireball, and one of the seed suppliers is blending them and marketing this as Obsidian. Hat Trick is the one I like, but these new ones are very similar and I'm testing them myself. Why would they change from one to another? Well, there's dozens of people breeding grass, turf grass seed out there, companies breeding turf grass seed out there. They're always looking for better disease resistance, deeper color, slower growth, faster growth, depending on what their goal is. This whole category of these new dark green perennial ryegrass, there'll be different names, but the ones that I'm mentioning, Hat Trick or Obsidian, are two that you're likely to find. I go to Twin City Seed in Minnesota for that one. TwinCitySeed.com. That's who I get it from, and you can buy it from them just as well as I can. And then I'm looking at a turf grass variety of hard fescue. Now, when I first went into business, hard fescue was a pasture grass. It wasn't something that was used in lawns. But the greater drought tolerance, the somewhat slower growth habit, the fine texture, and the good density of hard fescue made some of the turf grass seed breeders look at it as a possibility for lawn grasses, especially in drier climates like ours. And the one that I've been recommending, which is available, is called Stonehenge. So that's a type of hard fescue. The company I get that from is Hearn Seed Company, HEARNE, in King City, California. Hearnseed.com. And I've had great results with them. More to the point, you can also buy from them. So if you're listening somewhere way far away and you want to know where I'm getting a hold of these, those are the two sources, TwinCitySeed.com and Hearnseed.com. We usually then ask if people are having us blend this for them, is there any shade? Is any of your lawn going to be in shade? And after the couple gets through arguing about that, they'll usually tell us that some percentage of it is in the shade. So we'll add some creeping red fescue. Creeping red fescue is a really pretty turf grass when you grow it all by itself as a ground cover. That's a soft meadow-looking one that you'll sometimes see seeded 100%, not blended with anything else, and left unmowed. It's really good for that purpose. No-mow lawns, eco lawn, are typically at least 50% creeping red fescue because they can be left unmowed, make a lovely meadow appearance. But they also can be mowed as long as you set your mower as high as you possibly can. They will grow in sun, but creeping red fescue is the most shade tolerant turf species there is. So we will recommend that little 10, 20, 30% of the seed be creeping red fescue. There aren't that many varieties of creeping red fescue, but one is called Boreal. It's most common, works well. Newer forms are coming on the market. They're improved, usually darker green color. That's about the main difference they have. A little denser, perhaps. If it can be mowed shorter, that would be great. You'll see some changes in that as time goes by. But if you're in a hardware store or a nursery in your area and you see something that says shade and sun mix, it's almost sure to have at least 20% creeping red fescue because that's the one that they've added for the shade. And the next question typically is, how much do you need? A pound will cover anywhere from 100 to 300 square feet. That's quite a range, I realize, but it depends on what's there right now. Bare soil, pound per 100 square feet. Existing lawn, but looking kind of thin, up to 300 square feet. A lot of people just shoot for the middle and do about a pound for 200 square feet. Okay, that's fine. You can even seed at higher rates if you want to. That's no problem. The timing. In Northern California, interior Southern California, coastal zones where we are, USDA zones 9 and 10, October through November into early to mid-December is optimal. Second best time is generally February into early March. And that's only second best because you're going into warmer, drier weather, not cooler, rainier weather. The perfect time to overseed is to go out right when a rainstorm is coming in and throw the seed out as the clouds are moving over. And that way, you don't even have to worry about top dressing it. You don't even have to worry about watering it. Typically, even if you only get half an inch to an inch of rain, a couple of days of cloud cover and cooler, damper conditions will be fine. So you won't have to carefully water them as you would have to do if you're doing this in the spring or early summer. You should, if we get a north wind, go ahead and water a few minutes each day. But typically, you don't have to worry that much about it when you do this in the month of November or into early December here in the Sacramento Valley. And if you want a tougher lawn, you're looking for something that's going to take more play, more wear, more traffic, then you'd look at the tall fescues or the dwarf fescues, and that's a different conversation. Any of you interested in tougher turf species, send us a note. We can have a conversation about that. But the combination of this hard fescue Stonehenge, the perennial ryegrass hat trick, or their similar newer varieties, and the creeping red fescue is what we've been recommending with good results here in the Sacramento Valley. Key thing, best not to mow it below 3 inches if you possibly can. Higher you can mow it, the better the fescues will do.
Next, let's talk about ailanthus. Ailanthus altissima. What is its common name?
Tree of Heaven.
It's very, not very heavenly.
A curiously inappropriate name for it. Yeah, ailanthus altissima, Tree of Heaven. Someone posted a question recently on Nextdoor, and I don't participate that much on Nextdoor, but I do follow some of the conversations. And they said, they had a picture of a stand of ailanthus tree on a city green belt. And the question was, why doesn't the city cut this down? It's one of those kind of questions. Why doesn't the city cut this down? And threw in the additional comment, which is the relevance of this. It's known to be a big host for the spotted lantern fly, and that's spreading in the United States. So shouldn't we be making an effort to get rid of ailanthus? Yes, Charlie in Brooklyn, I know you guys are battling spotted lantern fly and you have all this information back there, what the egg masses look like and how to trap the adults in places where spotted lantern fly has arrived and is established. It's spreading and doing a lot of leaf chewing and injury to plants. And in general, it's a very challenging pest to control. It showed up in Pennsylvania. It spread throughout the Northeast. We'll get back to that in a moment. Ailanthus altissima was actually introduced in the United States intentionally. It was the first urban forestry tree. It was introduced because it is tough, tolerates soil compaction, terrible soil, can take wet soil conditions, tolerates pollution. So it was a really good choice for urban areas, or so they thought. And it grew really, really fast. And also, it was introduced, let's see, I believe Wikipedia tells us the exact date it was introduced, but in the 1700s, there was a little bit of a vogue right then for everything Chinese, Chinese art. And this is a plant from China. It has big, lush, ferny-looking leaves. They're very attractive. It really is, I hate to say this, an attractive plant. And so it was planted intentionally for that reason, in the late 1700s. It is probably the most invasive woody species in North America. It has spread everywhere that it has been planted and a lot of places that it wasn't planted. And when I first came up here to Northern California, I was told three different stories. One was the one I just told you, that it was introduced intentionally as an urban forest tree and because of the lovely leaves back east. What I was also told when I took arboriculture here was it was introduced by Chinese immigrants to California as a familiar tree from where they came from, and it grew quickly and grew readily. And indeed it does. And Chinese immigrants came into California in the 19th century to help drain the Delta, build the railroads, and up in gold country. There's lots of ailanthus up in gold country. The other story I was told was it followed the railroad tracks, which is certainly plausible as they went across the country. Some of the biggest stands of ailanthus that you will see are right along the railroad tracks. I don't know that it followed the railroad tracks, but I will say this, the way the railroad industry manages vegetation certainly encouraged it. Because one of the things about ailanthus is you can spray it with almost any herbicide you can think of, including things they were using 100 years ago that you don't want to know about. It'll kill everything there except the ailanthus. It'll kill the top of the ailanthus and it'll resprout. So you've now created a nice bare open line going across the United States for ailanthus to follow. And in the rainier parts of the U.S., I think that's certainly a plausible explanation for its rapid spread, was that it just followed along the railroad tracks. Ailanthus does one thing whenever it invades an area. It is definitely known to be allelopathic. Allelopathy is the characteristic of a plant putting chemicals in the soil one way or another that suppresses the growth of other plants. And so it would make its own stand where nothing else will grow. So if you kill out everything else with an herbicide, the railroads were doing, using things as simple as diesel oil, and then up sprouts the ailanthus, and then it essentially poisons the soil for other plants, you'll have a pretty solid stand of ailanthus altissima. So it is very, very challenging to control this plant.
And one of the things about it is that you can cut down a mature tree and treat that ring of growth like with, you know, with poisons like people do and kill that dead. But the roots are still alive and they are able to resprout from those roots. So it's one of those trees where killing the top's not enough.
No, if you cut it down, you can go buy various herbicides. The most common is, that they're using is triclopyr, not glyphosate. Someone's going to recommend that. It's not going to be as effective as triclopyr if you happen to be doing this. Read the label, read all about it. But you did basically put that full strength right on the visible cambium. In other words, the phloem and xylem portion right beneath the bark, that ring. And that'll usually kill that part. But as noted, it can sprout very readily from growth buds that are further down on that stump and also from the relatively shallow roots. And like many riparian species, it has roots that go way out. And we had one show up on our farm, the nearest female tree, they're male and female ailanthus. The nearest female tree is about a mile away around the corner. It has those kind of samara seed structures, as maples have, that go like little helicopters and go floating on the breeze. And that's undoubtedly how it showed up on our property. And boy, is this ever a case of, I should have dug it out when I first saw
Yes,
it.
you did.
But within 2 years, that plant was 20 feet, and I cut it down and treated it with the then appropriate tree and stump killer, same thing you'll buy at most places today, and it killed that. Oh, great. 2 feet away, up came several shoots. And I can tell you that now I have about 10 feet along the county road where it keeps coming back. So yes, just treating that one stump is not going to do it. Once you cut it down, you now have a thicket of tree of heaven instead of a single tree. And it's not any better in that regard, that each shoot will now need to be cut and treated if you're going to go that route. If you're on a rural property and you have vehicle access, it's probably more effective, and we did this once a few years ago, to literally just scrape off the whole root system with a tractor, just push off the top 6 inches of soil, take it all away. They put it on a burn pile or something, hopefully, but take it away, okay? And then monitor where those roots were, because little bits will tend to resprout. So there's definitely going to be follow-up needed. So as to why the city doesn't cut it down, well, the city could cut it down and keep cutting it down and keep cutting it down. I don't think that the public in Davis would be particularly thrilled about them doing a whole lot of herbicide treatment. They probably would need to come in and dig it out completely, and you'll have to continue abatement for several years. So this would become, this picture that they posted, I could take 50 pictures like that around the Davis area of ailanthus in different places. It would become a major expense to the city's urban forestry department. And in my opinion, they're underfunded as it is, much less with something like this. Managing ailanthus usually becomes an intergovernmental task force project. My guess is, if the spotted lantern fly does make it to California and does hit some of our crop plants, the USDA, California Department of Food and Agriculture, and the local Ag Commissioner will probably develop a spotted lantern fly task force, as they've done on other things. They'll probably implement some quarantines, as they've done for other pest problems. And ailanthus management will be a part of that. But that's the only way you'd ever get this done. We don't have enough money in the city's tree program to embark on aggressive removal of ailanthus. So what they'll do is they'll keep cutting it down. You could probably do that too. It's definitely not a city street tree. You can probably cut it down as well. You can follow the label directions. If you're going to go in that direction, there's really extensive and useful safety information available from the places where tree of heaven and spotted lantern fly in particular are becoming a big problem. Pennsylvania, where it first showed up, the extension folks in the University of Pennsylvania have excellent information. I want you to read about that before you even buy the chemical to control it. And it might be better to hire a professional to do that part so that the pesticide, if you're going to use it, the herbicide is going to be used correctly. And be aware this is going to be an ongoing process. But first of all, make sure of what you have, because ailanthus looks like a lot of other trees we have here. I have a picture that I post periodically when these questions come up of ailanthus, pecan, walnut, Chinese pistache, and sumac, all of which have the same kind of compound leaves. They all look very similar. Ailanthus leaves tend to be the biggest in that group, but they all look very similar. There's one really easy way to tell an ailanthus from all the others. Crush a leaf and smell it. It smells like funky compost. It smells like unpleasant compost. It's not a pleasant smell, but it's not horrible, but it's very distinctive. The smell of ailanthus foliage is quite distinctive.
So I want to go back to the spotted lantern fly.
Yeah.
And the problem is that this person said, oh, take out the ailanthus because it's a host. Well, maples and oaks and
Yeah.
walnuts and peaches and nectarines and plums and
Yeah.
roses and mulberries and sycamore and apples and pears And cottonwoods and willows and grapes, those are all hosts for the thing. So taking out ailanthus is not going to solve the problem.
No,
We don't
ailanthus
have
is.
it here yet,
Yeah,
thank
we don't have
goodness.
this. Spotted lanternfly showed up in Pennsylvania 2014. It's now established all over the Northeast. So it spreads pretty quickly. It's not a fly, by the way. It's a leaf, a plant hopper. And so it's actually kind of pretty. You can look it up. Spotted lanternfly, very recognizable. In areas where it's a problem, like New York, like Brooklyn, for example, the public is informed about it and they'll post pictures and there's lots of information about what the egg masses look like. It's very helpful to find those and destroy them. It is helpful to catch and destroy the adults. Yeah, managing ailanthus would be great. And places where it's everywhere, that's just going to be a huge challenge. But yeah, let's run through that host range. Maple, oaks, walnuts, peaches, nectarines, plums, roses, mulberries, sycamores, apples and pears, cottonwoods, willows, and grapes are among the many hosts of the spotted lanternfly, which is a leaf-feeding insect. I see grapes on there, so I'm guessing that the wine grape industry will be concerned about this. So that will probably be the impetus for any action by the Department of Food and Agriculture. What makes it unique is that ailanthus is toxic, and they feed on it, and they become toxic. So birds don't feed on the spotted lanternfly, much as with the monarch butterfly feeding on milkweed. It's the same idea. They're feeding on a plant that makes them toxic to songbirds, so they tend to increase in the presence of ailanthus. It's reasonable to adopt a policy of trying to get rid of ailanthus if you can, as part of a process of managing spotted lanternfly. Both of those will be very difficult. We need to monitor these new invasive pests and be aware that they don't adapt equally well to every climate. So a lot of the things that are a big problem back east may or may not become a problem here. We monitor, quarantines are put in place. Pesticides are registered or labeled for use on them if appropriate. In most cases, we'll probably, like as with this, the brown marmorated stink bug, we probably won't be doing anything about it as gardeners. But it is something to be aware of that you'll be reading about if and when it shows up here.
So we usually end our shows with a quote, and this time Don was given a book by the library person that we have a fellow. Are we allowed to say his name on air?
Andrew.
Andrew. And he saves the garden books for Don to give to the schools and all that sort of stuff. And he brought a book for me. He gave it to Don, and I'll get it pretty soon. But Don showed me this one page, and here's our garden quote for the day. This is by Henri Frederic Amiel, and it's from The Gardener's Guide to Life. A modest garden contains, for those who know how to look and wait, more instruction than a library.
Ties it all together beautifully. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.